Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Hi, dear listeners, and welcome to this week's Radio Sai Answering Booth, a place where you can drop your questions about practical spirituality, and I'll be coming up with answers for them with prayers to Swami, of course. So let me begin then by offering my most loving salutations at Swami's lotus feet. It's the Christmas season, and we are just a few days away from the Christmas day. Really, listeners, there is nothing much in a particular day. What makes the day important is that we choose to celebrate that day, and we choose to remember a god, deity, or a noble soul on that particular day. When that is the case, how can a celebration be complete without remembering the person for whom we are celebrating it? And the person being celebrated called himself the messenger of God. In that case, doesn't it go without saying that a celebration of that person without paying attention or recalling the message would make the celebration incomplete? You know, in the past, when there were no cell phones and other forms of communication, the only way to send an emergency message was to send a telegram. And people always would panic when a telegram comes, because it must be about some emergency news. And they would say that if innocent people in villages in India, whose relatives were in the army, receive a telegram, they would immediately start wailing even without reading the message. In fact, how many of us do that? We start celebrating or panicking just after seeing a letter, even before opening the envelope and reading it. Isn't that an absurd thing to do? Well, we are basically reacting with excitement to the carrier of the message and not responding to the real message. Same would be the case if we celebrate the birthday of this messenger of God and overlook the message that he actually brought. So let us vow to celebrate and imbibe the message. Nothing will make the messenger and the one who sent the message happy. So let us begin today with a quote which really asks us this very question. Are we trying to live the message? These are the words of a Dutch Catholic priest and author, Henri Nouwen. I hope I'm pronouncing the name right. But nevertheless, let's go on to the quote, and I quote. Did I offer peace today? Did I bring a smile to someone's face? Did I say words of healing? Did I let go of my anger and resentment? Did I forgive? Did I love? These are the real questions. I must trust that the little bit of love that I sow now will bear many fruits, here in this world and the life to come. End of quote. There is nothing to explain in that quote. These are questions, if we ask ourselves every day, our life could be a reflection of Swami, isn't it, dear listeners? And he also points out that faith, that we must also have faith in love. And the key to faith in love is patience. Imagine if the farmer who sows the seeds lacks the patience to let the seeds grow. We won't have food on our plates, don't we? Faith in love and patience is closely related. And going by the same example of sowing, faith is in believing that the seed is sprouting under the soil even when we cannot see it happening. Similarly, let us have the faith in love, the faith that love is working even when we cannot see it is working. So before moving on, let me read that quote of Henri Nouwen one more time. I quote, did I offer peace today? Did I bring smile to someone's face? Did I say words of healing? Did I let go of my anger and resentment? Did I forgive? Did I love? These are the real questions. I must trust that little bit of love that I sow now will bear many fruits here in this world and the life to come. With that let's then head to the questions of the week. Yes, like always, there are two questions, but both questions of today are asked by the same person, and the person who is asking those questions wishes to be anonymous. So we'll not name her, but we'll listen to the question. As always, I have Sister Sumana, one of our volunteers, reading out the question for us. So we'll listen to the question in Sister Sumana's voice, and then we will go to the answer.
Sai Ram, brother, I'm in a confused state now, so I do not know how clearly I can put in my thoughts here. My mind is taking me through a roller coaster ride. One day, I am very happy with feelings of gratitude to Swami for giving such a wonderful life. But the very next day, I feel so depressed, wondering what's happening. I'm a CA working in an NGO, a spiritual organization. Though the work I do doesn't require a professional, I have taken it up with the intention of being in that organization and being with like-minded people. Generally, I think my colleagues and boss are happy with me, and I am also happy in my office. Whenever people come to my office, I try to make them laugh, and I too get a chance to laugh. Now I am being given an additional assignment where I need to organize some events and so on for our staff, which requires more interaction with people around, which I am not feeling comfortable doing. Mostly, I push myself to do things, but sometimes I feel lazy to do them, so I avoid meeting people. How do I improve in this? That is to make myself more social to be with people. Next, with regards to my personal life, I am married for the last 12 years. We have not developed any sort of relationship. We are just two individuals living under one roof. I feel he doesn't want to separate because of the social stigma it may create. Whenever I try to start a personal conversation, he avoids it. When I ask him what he expects from me, he says that the kitchen should be clean or prepare food at the right time or such things. And even when I try to do these things, he has never acknowledged them. Instead, he would point out some other mistakes. When I cook something, he always comments that I could have made something else. Now, after these many years, I have lost interest in doing anything. Some days I make breakfast and lunch and go for work. Some other days, I lie in the bed up to 8 a.m. and then get up and rush to office. I try to return home as late as possible. We hardly talk to each other. Whenever he tells me something, it will be to ask me why I did it that way or why I did not do something, or to instruct me things like don't sit like this or don't do that. I am a well-respected professional outside. But he keeps telling me things like how to walk on the road or how to handle my handbag. End of it. I do not know what's my question to you, but I do feel light now. Please tell me how I should go about in my relationship. Thanks a lot for patience, Sairam.
Thank you for writing to me, sister, and glad that even asking that question actually made you feel a bit light. Issues such as these can be quite tough to deal with, and being here, it's easy for me to give advice, but it needs more patience, as I said, and also the belief that things will turn around from your side. Well, I'll share my thoughts from what I can read from your question, and I'm sure it will be helpful for you. From the first part of your question, let me first draw out a few conclusions, which is likely to point out to you where you stand in your work life as such. Well, you're employed in a position for which you are overqualified. In other words, you are happy with this arrangement as it gives you the opportunity to be with like-minded people. So that means you're not feeling inadequate or suffer from any sort of low esteem about your position in workplace. The fact that you're overqualified for the job, that you're doing that can lead to two outcomes. Either you could feel professional dissatisfaction that your capabilities are not being utilized, or you can feel very comfortable in a niche of respect and adoration that you created for yourself. I think for you, it is the latter. And also there is another fact too, which you mentioned, given that it is a spiritual NGO, you get the satisfaction of doing something purposeful. And the fact that you're overqualified also means you're respected by your colleagues. So in that sense, your work life as such is not a problem. The next point you say is you try to be cheerful and you generally spread cheer whenever someone walks into your cabin or desk. And also your colleagues and boss are happy with you. So from this, I would not be wrong in concluding that you actually don't have a problem working with people. If you ask me, the toughest thing is to make people laugh and cheerful. If you feel you're able to do that, you actually don't have a problem working with people, or you're not really asocial in that sense. Yes, you may prefer solitude over company. Still, you may prefer to work alone and doing something that involves, and not prefer doing something that involves other people. But you don't necessarily have a problem working with people as such. So first and foremost, do away with this idea that you have a problem with people or working with people. I think that's the first step. So let's see if we can identify what the problem could be. One is, as I said, you are in a comfort zone with people respecting you for your work, things going well with your profession as such. So maybe you don't wish to experiment with something new where you could possibly fail. This is likely to happen with all of us. You know, but sometimes we are able to spot the real reason, and when we do that, half the issue will be sorted out. The other reason could be you may not be a person who can get work done from others. Not that you don't like working with people, but if asked to lead a group or asked to make a set of individuals work, it may be difficult for you. So firstly, try and recognize which of these two could be your problem. It is not like one is bad or the other is better. We all have our issues. So the first step is to recognize and acknowledge what the issue is. If it is about you not willing to come out of your comfort zone, then challenge yourself. Tell yourself that I want to see how I fare in this new role. It is difficult, but I want to push myself. Actually, this will help you get over your overall problem of losing interest too. Don't fear failure. I think this is anyway an important thing to do because of the stage of life you are in. But I think I'll come to that when I answer the second part of your question. If your issue is that you're not good at getting people to work, one good option would be to find two or three people in your group who are good at that. Instead of you managing the whole group, you can probably try managing your team through these two or three individuals. That way, they too will feel empowered and you will be able to get the team to work effectively too. But maintain this only as an interim measure, for I'm sure with time you can figure out how to deal with people and get work done yourself. Let me also add another tip for any general diffidence we generally feel, especially in work. It could be any of these feelings. I'm not good at this. I don't like to do this. I'm not qualified to do this. Try and make the work at hand larger than yourself. And working in an NGO, that should be easier for you to do because automatically your work is attached to a higher purpose and larger good. There's a beautiful story from the life of Emperor Shivaji, I recall. Apparently in the Raigad fort that Shivaji had made, that fort was built by Shivaji, and there he had this rule that the doors will open at sunrise every day and close at sunset. You know, as we all know, the main fort will have a main gate. So those doors will open only at sunrise and would close at sunset, and nobody would be able to enter it after sunset. So once closed, they will never be open till morning. So if you're inside that fort and the doors close, you're inside the fort till the next morning. So people in the village would go to the fort in the morning to do their business and will have to leave before the gates close. Otherwise, they cannot go back that night. And the fort was built right on top of a hill and there is no other way to come down. Even if one were to scale one of the walls, There was on the other side a thick jungle and no one would dare to come through that way. And this was the reason the Raigad fort under Shivaji was considered one of the most secure fortresses which no enemy could even dream of conquering. It seems there used to be a milkmaid who would come to the fort every morning when the gates opened, and she would sell her milk to the people living inside the fort and go back to her village down before the sunset. One day she gets late, and by the time she reaches the gates after selling her milk, the guards have already closed the gates. She becomes very desperate because she has left her infant at home and come. So she starts begging the guards to open the gate, but they flatly refuse, saying once the gates are closed, they don't open for anyone. The story goes that this lady was so desperate, thinking of her hungry baby at home, that she scales the wall of the fort, the other side of which is that thick jungle that I mentioned, and she walks through the jungle and reaches home. The next day when the guards open the gate, the milkmaid comes as usual in front of the door, and they are shocked to see her come from outside. They catch her and take her to their head and explain what happened. And the lady coolly says that I had to go back to my child, and I had no other option, so I scaled the fort walls and reached home through the jungle. So finally they all take her to Emperor Shivaji himself, who hears the entire account and is astonished too. And he says, this is the power of a mother's selfless love. A fort which is impregnable for the mightiest of enemies could not stop a mother who wanted to do her duty. The reason I was reminded of this story is the moment we consider the duty at hand larger than ourselves, our limitations, our abilities, likes and dislikes become insignificant. Of course, this story is about a mother and her selfless love. Her sense of duty was backed by a selfless love. But the mother did not think, can I do this? Is it possible? Nothing. She said, my child is alone. I have to go feed the child. These were the only thoughts. That duty of the moment made her do what had to be done. Same is the case with life in general too. The moment we make the task at hand more important, especially if that is our duty, our dharma, we will overlook our limitations and preferences. In fact, this is the essence of the karma yoga that Arjuna taught Krishna, isn't it? And Arjuna was taught by Krishna, isn't it? Krishna said, this is your dharma. There is no question of whether you like to do it or not. Make your dharma larger than yourself. Forget yourself and do the task at hand. You can keep this as a general yardstick, especially when you feel I'm not interested in doing this work or this is not my kind of work. And I think it should be a little more easy, as I said, for you as you're working in an NGO. The work that you do now should be attached to a larger good or cause. So it should be easier for you to feel your work is important and more important than your likes and dislikes. Even otherwise, the moment we consider what has been assigned to us as our dharma and we have to do it to the best of our ability, we will be able to put aside our likes and preferences, even our limitations, and accomplish the task at hand. So let me come to the next part of your question. From all that you mentioned about your family life, it's of course clear that your husband does not seem to appreciate things you do or even doesn't appreciate you as a person. But if we conclude that, then our solution will be in how to deal with the person your husband is. But there could be some fundamental issues here, given that even you are not able to feel like you are more than just two individuals living under the same roof. And also considering the phase of life you both are in too, we can probably read a little more into the situation than just the idea that your husband disregards you. Let me try to explain that by going into the working of our human minds a little. Now, the mind can be said to have two simple components, the conscious mind and the subconscious mind. The subconscious mind has memories of our past and also has a deeper understanding of what we go through in life. But this conscious mind, the mind we work with every day, is strongly attached to the body. At least most of us, that is the case. This part of the mind believes its age is the age of the body. And so the desires of this mind are closely interlinked with the desires of the body, and the desires of the body are related to the age of the body. And that is the reason why as we grow in age, things that give us happiness and more so fulfillment changes with time. Just look back at your own life and you will see that what mattered to you so much when you were a teenager does not matter so much now. And what is so important to you now could become insignificant when you are in old age. The point I'm trying to make is, in every stage in life, certain events and achievements are linked to happiness in our mind. And achieving them, or even more than that, pursuing them, keeps our mind active, excited, and happy. The mind needs something to look forward to constantly, and what it looks forward to keeps changing with age. Of course, in spirituality, we try to deal with this nature of the mind. Once we recognize that this is the nature, we slowly stop depending on objects outside for our joy. But that is a long-drawn practice and we cannot completely negate the mind overnight, right? But it is not wrong to satisfy the mind's needs, but as long as it is within the bounds of dharma. And in fact, it has to be done to maintain a balance in life and a balance in society, more importantly. When young, there is curiosity and energy. So we give the mind the right kind of knowledge and the right ways of expending that energy, isn't it? Similarly, as we grow, the mind needs certain achievements. We go after them, again, within the limits of dharma. And this is built into our brains biologically, actually. Imagine if this does not happen. All of us in our 30s and 40s will still be playing with sand and toys, isn't it? So when these legitimate needs of the mind are not met, there will be depression to a certain extent. So in your case, you and your husband are in that stage in life where you need to seriously sit down and discuss about raising a family. Maybe your husband does not say it openly, or maybe he even does not realize it himself. But the fact is, there is very little really that you both can look forward to, and that is the main cause of this dullness or disinterestedness. When at it, let me make a few general points from what I've said also. It is not that without a reason we have culturally followed a certain time schedule. At what age one should get married, at what age one should have a family, and also at what age one should start renouncing comforts, what is referred to as vanaprastha ashrama in our scriptures. These were all laid out on the basis of the needs of the mind and keen observation of the human psyche. That is the role religion and culture is meant to play also. It brings harmony within an individual and also in a society. But what do? We try to live the life of a teenager well into our 20s and even 30s. Then we feel our professional pursuits are good enough and ignore the family life. And the worst thing is, we try to postpone our old age by living the life of a youngster even after we grow old, pursuing the same passions, hobbies and interests. And we claim that we are keeping ourselves young at heart. But the reality is, this completely wrecks our inner balance and the balance in society. That is also why many times we see people not having fulfillment in life. There are two other problems which are related to this nature of the mind. One is, we give way too much importance to our passions sometimes. We have to keep it in mind as we grow, our priorities do change. We have to leave little space for that change. We often hear youngsters say, "This is it. My life depends only on this. If this event does not happen, life is not worth living." Well, this sort of thinking comes because we don't acknowledge that our minds and things that the mind needs for fulfillment change from time to time. The other problem is, yes, the mind needs change from time to time, but we should not over cater to the mind. If we cater to the mind every time it needs a change, then the mind's ability to be happy with anything will be lost. We will not be happy doing anything or having anything. We will only have a fleeting happiness when that small change happens. We will feel only that interim satisfaction. This actually leads to more boredom and being distracted all the time. So the balance is, there are some legitimate needs of the mind which is not wrong to attend to, but those have to be attended to at the right time. If the mind demands too often, then we must discipline it by allowing that phase to pass without catering to the mind. And sister, the issue of lack of interest that you face now will only increase as you head towards your midlife. Even people with families face what is called a midlife crisis. But the action that you take now, what I am suggesting, is best done now at this age than later. So it is a good time for both of you to sit down and discuss about raising a family. You may wonder how this is related to the problems you face at home with your husband, but it will make a difference. As I've explained before on the show, the process of raising children brings in far more discipline and selflessness in the parents as individuals than we ever acknowledge. It almost streamlines our lives. Especially when you are dharmically on that path, you're already married. It also becomes essential to an extent. So let me quickly try to summarize my answer. The first part of your question was about your work life. As I can see, working with people is not your problem really. It could either be that you are uncomfortable taking up something new or you are not used to leadership roles. If the issue is about leadership and you are not good at getting people to work, one option is to identify few people and manage the group through those people till you feel more comfortable. But in general, any form of diffidence that we feel when we're given a task, be it because we don't like doing the job or we feel we are not good enough for that job, one way to deal with it is to make the task at hand more important than ourselves. If we consider the work given to us as important and it has to be done, my dharma is to do it, then we will slowly be able to put behind our diffidence. Most of us struggle because we put ourselves before our work. Then coming to the issues in the family, as I can see, both of you lack that something to look forward to. The stage of family life you are in has probably outlived its time. I mean, lasted for a bit too longer than it had to. So what would have probably given you joy so far is not good enough to keep your mind happy anymore. The dharmic way to deal with this is to consider raising a family. And for that, both of you will have to sit down and patiently discuss that out. That will give you a new responsibility and purpose in life. It will also change your husband as a person for sure. A lot of couples these days postpone making this decision till too long. What happens if you don't raise a family? Well, nothing. With time, you will only get used to living the way you just said you are living. And there is a strong chance that you will be left with this vacuum, this feeling of unfulfillment for life, both you and your husband. So, dear sister, thank you for writing to me. If there is anything more you wish to ask, please do write again. Dear listeners, as I said, there was only one question that today I had to answer, and that question had two parts. So that was the question that I had to take up. But I thought, since we still have some time, I will share a few of my thoughts and also read out something for you, which I've read long back, which is very, very interesting and very moving for me. On this program, we answer many questions. A lot of people ask us questions, and most of the times the answers which we give calls for some change in their life and their life's patterns. And the question is, how easy is it to make that change? How easy is it to change things in our life? It's very easy to give advice, and being here, I can tell you that for sure. But does a person really change in life? Does transformation really happen? That's a question that oftentimes it comes to our mind. Because one thing which we read often in our scriptures, and we've heard even Swami say, that the past tendencies or vasanas play a very, very strong role in our life. We make choices based on what our past has been like. We make decisions based on our past tendencies. So how much choice do we really have to change? If we decide to transform ourselves or change a certain aspect of our life, do we really have the ability to make that choice and effect that change in our lives? This is a question which often comes to our mind, but the one thing which we can say for sure is, The very fact that Swami spent a huge amount of his time teaching us how to change our life only gives us the hope that there is a possibility that change can happen if we choose to make it happen. And that is where our hope lies. And that is where we must place our faith too. Among the many habits which are considered to be addictive, one of the habits which they say is the most difficult to get over is the habit of addiction to drugs, or what we refer to as substance abuse. And one of the reasons it is more difficult is, after a certain point, it is this addiction which actually goes beyond the level of making choices and the mind. It becomes a biological change in the brain. So after that point, it becomes very difficult to even make that choice and change. And there are innumerable examples of Swami helping people out of such habits. And what I'm going to read to you today is about one such person who got over this habit, and it's a very, very moving story. It's about one of Swami's own classmates, and he was a doctor. His name is Dr. Meera Mohinuddin, if I got that name right. He's a classmate of Swami from Swami's Uruvakunda days. We know that Swami declared his avatarhood when he was in Uruvakunda, and this person was Swami's classmate in the school in Uruvakunda. And this was an article which was actually published in the Sanatan Sarthi in the year 1977, the December issue. I'm not going to explain to you what actually happened. I'm going to just read out that article because it's self-explanatory and it's so beautiful. And I do hope you will feel as energized as I feel every time I read this article. So let me read out the account of the experience of Dr. Meera Mohinuddin, a classmate of Swami, the article which was published in Sanatan Sarthi. I am a registered medical practitioner, engaged since years in my profession in Uruvakunda. As a result of some unforeseen circumstances and their effect on my mental condition, I got involved in a vicious habit, namely taking injections of morphia. It began with 2 injections per day. Within 8 days, more correctly, on and from the 20th of June 1968, I fell into the habit of taking 4 injections per day. In another fortnight, I needed 8, and within a month after that, I was forced to give myself 16 injections of morphia. In about a month more, the quantity the body clamored for increased to 20 injections. This continued for only 3 months more, for later I had to take 30 injections every day. I could not for the life of me discover any method by which I could reduce the intake. My income from medical practice was about 800 to 1000 rupees per month. All that income proved insufficient for the morphia I had to give myself. I had to sell off 5 acres of my lands for 13,000 rupees. This amount, plus the money I got from patients, sufficed only for 16 months for me. I sold another 3 acres for 10,000 rupees. That pulled me through for another 16 months. I had no money remaining with me at the end of that period. Then I sold the building sites I had in the town for another 6,000 rupees and spent it on the morphia during the next 8 months. The income coming from remaining lands I clung to, and every pie of my earning was swallowed by this vicious habit that had possessed me. I have 10 children, 6 girls and 4 boys. My wife had died. I had never paid any thought during all these years on how the poor things were managing to exist. Of course, they suffered much for want of food and clothing. They went through manifold miseries. They used to wait outside my room, and when they saw some patient giving me any little money, they would cry piteously for the same. "Father, give it to us. We shall purchase some grains with it, some snacks." I used to drive them away with foul interjections. I never worried over what they ate or how they managed. Some patients who came to me used to pay them now and then part of the fees they had to give me. and with this meager source, they kept flesh and bone together. 9 years passed thus. I was driven to such despair that I started tackling the problem. How to get rid of this vice? For I could not even reduce the intake by the slightest. When I had on some days to take less than on the previous days, I suffered extreme agony, pain all over the body, yawning, sweating, fear, effusion of saliva, stuttering cramps. These gave me great distress. How could I then stop the injections altogether? How could I escape from the coils of this drug? On account of the high cost of this habit, my family had been ruined. My medical practice declined and dried up. My physical health also got deteriorated from day to day. Of course, I repented in my heart of hearts for this fault, but what could I do? I found it impossible to escape. One of my friends who had fallen victim to morphia had gone to Madras and returned after a cranial operation by which they said this habit could be got rid of. Another doctor friend too had gone to Madras and stayed there for 4 months. After undergoing treatment there, he had given up the morphia habit. But the first friend had spent 3,500 rupees and the second friend had spent 5,000 rupees. I too decided to go, but I had no money at all. Yet, I had to continue the injections. I begged, borrowed, and visited hospitals and somehow managed to pull through with a minimum quota of 30 to 35 injections. 9 years passed by. I had run through 40,000 rupees during that period. I could not free myself from this habit or even reduce the intake. I realized that one can free himself from the jaws of a crocodile sooner than from the jaws of morphia. Meanwhile, a Bhajan Samaja had started working in our town by the devotees of Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. They held their bhajans at the Subramanyeshwara temple near my house. My friend, Dr. Anjaneyalu, was its organizer. One day, a Thursday, I went into the temple and sat in the far distant corner, listening to the bhajan songs. During the bhajan, a desire arose in my mind. That is to say, Baba, you were my classmate here in the high school years ago. You must be remembering me. You must be knowing the depths to which this habit has dragged me. There are some who doubt you, many who adore you as God. I am not involving myself in that controversy now. I want to find from my own experience the truth. Well, if you can bless me with the mental courage and strength to get out of this vicious morphia habit, I shall believe that you are God. With this vow taken with a full heart, I steadied myself. Within a few seconds, the bhajan ended. They distributed Vibhuti Prasadam to everyone, holding the packets in my palm as a precious gift and resolving to rely upon Baba for the strength to free myself, I returned home. I decided that whatever might happen, however hard the conditions, I would not take a single injection of morphia for full 3 days. If on the fourth day I am free from the tentacles of morphia, I shall adore Baba just as those people are doing at the Subramanyeshwara temple, I told myself. The first day, I did not take any injection. No, not even one. I had no calls of nature that day. I had profuse sweating, cramps in the muscles, burning sensation all over the body, wild imaginations, streams of tears, cough. These gave me a terrible time. But I swallowed small quantities of the vibhuti and carried on in spite of everything. The second day was worse. The urine and feces were full of blood. Frightful thoughts of suicide haunted me. The third day dawned. I had determined and sworn that day too I would not take morphia. I felt that I may not survive the third day. When night came on, I began shouting and wailing aloud in some kind of inexplicable pain. I hit the floor with my feet. I hit my head against the pillar. I blabbered wildly and loudly. The children wept and wailed, awakening the neighbors and the houses in the locality. Some friends of mine came in and, seeing my condition, they too shed tears in sympathy with the children. A doctor friend came at around 3 a.m. and, realizing that my pitiable condition was due to my not taking the morphia, he brought 4 injections with him. He told me, "I have brought these. Take the injections." But I replied, "Doctor, the promise I have given to Swami will lapse tomorrow. Keep the 4 safe until morning." The time was then 3:45 a.m. My children were sitting all around me. I told my little daughter, Hafisa Begum, "Go and get me the vibhuti of Swami I have kept in the shelf over there." She brought it and gave me. I took a pinch and placed it on my tongue and drank some water to wash it down. In about 10 minutes, I fell asleep. During sleep, I felt as if I was on a pilgrimage. I slept soundly until 11 a.m. the next morning, the 4th day. Exactly as promised, the doctor friend, hearing that I had awakened from sleep, came at about 12 noon with the 4 morphia injections. When he came, I was reclining in my easy chair, calm and collected, with no sign of any after effect. No cough, no sneeze, no haw, no hum. The doctor asked me softly, "Dear friend, how do you feel?" I replied equally softly, "By Swami's grace, my mind is clear and calm." Then he said, "In that case, I believe you have no need of this morphia." I said in a firm tone, "No, there is no need." The doctor was overjoyed. "Ah, what happy news you have given us. How pleasant to the ears. At last, after all these years, Swami has showered his grace on you," the doctor said, and going out into a fruit shop, he brought 2 apples and, placing them in my hands, he left with the morphia that he had brought for me. Since that day, 3 months back, I have never had the slightest inclination towards morphia. My health has improved a great deal and is getting better and better every day. My medical practice has also picked up fast. My children are happy. The Wednesday after my recovery from the hold of the crocodile morphia, I joined the Rangar Sankirtan group that passed before my house, and reaching the Subramaneshwara temple with them, I related to all the devotees of Bhagwan the story of my vow and its fulfillment. My friends, relatives and all well-wishers were all very happy when they came to know of Baba's grace. I have now no doubt that the divine will of Swami can cure everyone suffering from such vicious habits, provided they surrender to Him. For myself, I am convinced that He is divine and that His grace alone has saved me and can save me. So that, dear listeners, is that article which I said, which was published in the Sanatan Sarthi in 1977, December. Well, if there is any doubt in our minds, is change possible? Well, of course it is. And as that person so beautifully said, as long as we trust that Swami is standing by our side and is ready to help us, you know, oftentimes we ask ourselves, you know, where do we see Swami's love? When we take to the wrong ways, when we become unmanageable in the human eyes, people may leave us. You know, friends may leave us, relatives may leave us, even husbands and wives may abandon us. But if any point down the road, if we decide to turn back, if we decide to take to the right path, and if we make that choice, as this person said, then Swami is ever standing there and ready to hold a hand and guide. And I think that is the expression of His universal love, isn't it? that, dear listeners. It's a wrap on this week's show. Thank you for joining me. Do you have a question on Swami's message and how we can practically implement it in our day-to-day life, or a problem or for which you're wondering what would be Swami's instruction for us, then Radio Sai Answering Booth is for you. Send me your questions by mail, and my mail ID is prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. Well, that's my personal mail ID, so confidentiality is guaranteed from my end. Like the listener today, if you wish to send me a question and you don't want to name yourself, I think that's workable. And if you could record your question and send it to me, I think that will be more than perfect. So dear listeners, if you have a question, that's my mail ID. I'll meet you all again in about an hour's time, 12:30. I'll be here for the afternoon satsang, but I'll meet you on the same program next week. Before I go, a Merry Christmas to all of you, and I'm going to leave you with one of my favorite English songs. The lyrics are beautiful, and the way it is rendered is equally beautiful. Thank you for being here. Do join me again next week at 11 a.m.
I keep feeling your love in me over and over again. I keep feeling your love in me over and over again. And it's sweeter and sweeter as the days go by. Oh, what a love between my sigh and I. I keep feeling your love in me over and over again. I keep feeling your love in me over and over again. And it's sweet and sweeter as the days go by. Oh, what a love between my sigh and I. I keep feeling your love in me over and over again. I keep feeling your love and sweeter as the days go by. Oh, what a love between my sigh and I. I keep feeling your love in me over and over again. I keep feeling your love. Days go by. Oh, what a love between my sigh and I. 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 My sigh and I keep feeling your love in me over and over again. I keep feeling your love in me over and over again. And it's sweeter and sweeter as the days go by. Oh, what a love between my sigh and I. I keep feeling your love in me over.
sweeter and sweeter as the days go by. Oh, what a love between my sigh and I. I keep feeling your love in me over and over again. I keep feeling your love in me over and over again. And it's sweeter and sweeter as the days go by. I keep feeling your love in me over and over again. I keep feeling your love in me over and over again. And it's sweeter and sweeter as the days go by. Oh, what a love between my sigh and I.